Does truth exist?
Because you have faith, does that make this book true?
Does God exist?
So when someone says there is no truth, if you apply the claim to itself, what should you say? Is that true? They don't think Christianity's true. They're talked out of it. You know why they're talked out of it? Because they've never been talked into it.
Cross-examining skeptical and atheistic views. Welcome to Cross-Examine with Dr. Frank Turek.
Ladies and gentlemen, how did we get here? And who's we and what am I talking about? The church. How did the church get to be in such a state that it's mostly emotional? It's quite often relativistic. Many people don't even care if it's true. It just works for them. And when I go out and do I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist seminars, quite frequently I get questions from people who have come to the seminar and like it. They ask me, well, how do I get my friends to care about this? How do I get people to even care whether Christianity is true or not? Even Christians, how do I get Christians to care about apologetics, to get them to even be concerned about knowing why Christianity is true? And how did the church get to where it is today? Has it always been this way? I mean, there are two streams of non-intellectualism or anti-intellectualism. I guess there's two things going on. There are some people who are non-intellectual, and then there are some people who are just anti-intellectual. Like, if you were to bring them intellectual reasons for why Christianity were true, they would reject them and say, you don't even need that. You just need to believe. You've run into this. People who listen to this program have run into this in other people. In fact, over at Southern Evangelical Seminary, from which I've graduated and on occasion teach, we sometimes ask our students, what's the greatest problem in America today? Is it ignorance or apathy? And one student answered, I don't know and I don't care. You know, I mean, that's kind of the culture we're in now. It's whatever, even in the church. I want to try and get to the bottom of this today if we can, as best we can. And I'm not qualified to get there on my own. That's why I have a friend of mine who is a church historian and runs a great ministry down in Atlanta. Dr. Jeffrey Brashears is on the line with me today and is going to be with me the entire hour to talk about how we got here and what can we do about it, and why is anti-intellectualism in the church and why is it such a problem? Dr. Jeffrey Brashears is with me. Jeff, thanks for being on the program with me today.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Frank. Certainly looking forward to the conversation.
Now, Jeffrey, you're down in Atlanta. Tell everybody about your ministry, what you do down there, and why people who are in the Atlanta area might want to get associated with what you do.
Well, certainly. Our ministry is called the Areopagus Christian Study Center, and we are an organization that provides seminars and workshops and forums on a lot of issues relevant to contemporary Christian life. Basically, our mission is to help educate and equip Christians so they can more effectively engage, you know, the society with the life-transforming truth and love of Jesus Christ. And so in that respect, we offer, I think, a very substantive seminary-level curriculum of courses, primarily geared toward Christian history, apologetics, and contemporary cultural issues.
And you have a PhD in history, is that right?
That's correct, uh-huh.
And yes. You taught history for many years down at Georgia State.
That's correct, yes. I taught at Georgia State University and also Kennesaw State University, which is also in Georgia here. And I started the Areopagus in 2003.
And if the folks out there listening want to learn more about this, particularly if you're in the Atlanta area, because this is a very, very deep and needed ministry. And I don't live in the Atlanta area, but I know many people that do, and they go to your classes, Jeffrey, and are very greatly informed and blessed by them. Go to theareopagus.org, theareopagus.org, to learn more. Now, Jeffrey, you put out a little pamphlet recently that I just read. In fact, you and I just had dinner the other night when I was down in Atlanta. And this little pamphlet's called The Problem of Christian Anti-Intellectualism. What's the problem with Christian anti-intellectualism? Why is it a problem?
Well, it's a pervasive problem, and I think Christian thinkers have realized this all throughout the 20th century. In fact, oftentimes I've reminded of a book that the Christian historian Mark Knoll wrote back in the early 1990s, and probably some of your listeners are familiar with this book, The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, and you might recall that the very first sentence of the book is that the scandal of the evangelical mind is that there isn't much of an evangelical mind. And it's a very astute critique of the lack of engaged thinking in our churches today. And Mark Knoll actually does a very credible job tracing the origins of this problem. But it's been a problem throughout certainly our lifetimes and, frankly, throughout the entire 20th century.
And, in fact, back in 2007, a couple of Jewish researchers were doing research into attitudes of college professors, and they were trying to discover if college professors were in any way anti-Semitic. And you know what they found? They didn't find any anti-Semitism, but they found anti-evangelicalism, mm-hmm. if that's a word. They found that 53% of college professors viewed evangelical students unfavorably. The next closest group were Mormons at about 30 or so percent, and the next closest group after that were Muslims at 22%. In other words, college professors viewed evangelical students unfavorably at a rate 2.5 times that they would view a Muslim student unfavorably. Now, don't get me wrong. I wish they'd view no student unfavorably out of the gate. But in my view, Jeffrey, it's that maybe they view evangelical students unfavorably because they deserve to be viewed unfavorably, because they show up at college not knowing one fact that can support their Christian worldview.
Well, unfortunately, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And of course, there's many reasons why that's the case. And we could talk about some of those later if you'd like. But certainly churches and, frankly, Christian families are not really preparing their students for the challenges they're going to engage once they hit the college scene. We're not preparing them intellectually in most respects, and also are not, of course, preparing them for the overwhelming moral challenges that await them as well.
Now, you've been to many churches, and I have been as well, and I get a lot of people saying, wow, I never heard this material before.
Yes.
Where has this been all my life? That kind of thing. And I know in this little pamphlet that you wrote called the little booklet called The Problem of Christian Anti-Intellectualism, in the very first page here, somebody once remarked to you after coming to the church, quote, Dr. Brashears talks to us like we're intelligent.
Yes,
if that's not an indictment on the rest of the church.
Well, that was actually one of the first churches I ever taught in when we began this ministry back in the early 2000s. And to say the least, I was a little taken aback, but in retrospect, it shouldn't have come as a great surprise. Minister went on to say that this issue had come up during a staff meeting, and now the staff were wondering, why that was the case and what was that supposed to say about them. And, of course, I very prudently didn't respond directly, but it is indicative of the fact that we have a lot of people in our churches today who would dearly love to go deeper and also broaden their knowledge and understanding of the Christian faith. And unfortunately, there's been a tremendous amount of resistance to higher-level thinking. As you know, as an apologist, you've probably encountered a tremendous amount of this apathy and outright resistance yourself, and it's very, very baffling. Because certainly I don't know of a single evangelical church that doesn't put a strong emphasis on evangelism and equipping their people to share their testimony effectively. But in a multicultural, pluralistic society like ours today, it's virtually impossible to be an effective witness for Christ without some sort of an apologetic foundation. And,
exactly.
And I think integral to that would be also an acquaintance, at least, with basic issues and controversies in Christian history.
And that's what we're going to talk about right after the break with my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Brashears. He's on for the entire hour with me. How did we get in this anti-intellectual or at least non-intellectual realm in the church today? More with Dr. Brashears right after this. Don't go away. Welcome back to Cross Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. If you're down low on the FM dial looking for NPR, go no further. You're actually going to hear the truth here. We're talking about why is the evangelical mind in many cases anti-intellectual? Why are our churches seem to have an allergy to apologetics? Why are some anti-intellectual? Why are some non-intellectual? How did we get here? We're talking to Dr. Jeffrey Brashears, who's on the line for the entire hour with me. We're talking about the problem of Christian anti-intellectualism. What can we do about it? How did it get here? And Jeffrey, before the break, we were just talking about the idea that many churches just seem to have an allergy to apologetics and the mind. And Jesus, of course, if he were here today, would not tell us that the mind is unimportant. In fact, he told us the greatest commandment, which included the mind. Tell us about that.
Well, yes, it's, of course, an integral part of the greatest commandment. We're also told in Proverbs 19, verse 2, it's not good to have zeal without knowledge. And as in all respects, Jesus is our model, and in Jesus we find the perfect integration of a zealous, passionate love for God and humanity, along with a very astute and sharp mind. And it's certainly a false dichotomy. I sometimes say that if I were forced to choose between a clean heart and a sharp mind, certainly I'd opt for the clean heart. But,
right.
You know, this is a totally false dilemma. And Jesus is our example in this respect. And in him we find, as I said, a perfect wholeness, a perfect integration in this respect.
I'll tell you, though, you got a feel for pastors out there who often need to, at least they perceive they need to, preach to the lowest common denominator. Jeffrey,
I'm afraid they oftentimes underestimate just exactly the potential in their congregations. I think too often the church just follows mainstream society and culture, and of course ours mm-hmm. is a lowest common denominator culture. Mm. We see this verified all the time in terms of declining academics and so on. And I think your experience, and certainly mine, has been that when we go into churches and challenge people to think more deeply and more broadly about their faith and the ramifications of their faith, we typically meet with a very enthusiastic, you know, acceptance.
You know, I found that to be true, actually, now that you mention it, that yes, if you challenge people, even young people, they appreciate it.
Absolutely.
They're tired of getting sermons that, you know, this sermon brought to you by the letter E. You know?
Yes.
they're tired of that. They want more. And I think even the research has borne this out with regard to education in general. And that is that teachers that challenge their students and expect a lot of their students actually have better students and get better results from their students than the ones that dumb everything down and try and preach to the lowest or teach to the lowest common denominator. So I think what you're saying is exactly right. Now, Jeffrey, the importance of the mind, obviously, in understanding the Bible is required, but it's even greater than I think what most people think, because in order to understand the Bible, people need to have a context, or to understand the context in which the Bible was written. So, Jeffrey, it seems to me that even the people out there who say, all I need is my Bible, I don't need anything else, don't realize that in order to understand the Bible, they have to understand a lot more about history and the context in which the Bible was written. And you, being an historian, can comment on it better than I can. So why don't you?
Well, certainly the wider context does nothing but enrichen our understanding of Scripture. And no history operates, of course, in a vacuum, and that would include Jesus' ministry here on earth and certainly the ministry of the early church. It's all within a particular cultural context. And so what history and biography can do is just further enrichen our understanding and shed a tremendous amount of light on just how perceptibly relevant the gospel message was, both in the time of Jesus and in the early church as well. These people are operating within certain cultural paradigms, and the more we understand that, the more effective we can appreciate their approach to ministry. And furthermore, it serves as a very good example of why we need to be culturally astute and culturally aware today as well.
You know, I ran into this recently on our TV program. We have a TV program, and right now we're going through the book of Romans, and we just recorded a show a couple weeks ago on Romans chapter 9. And you know what? How controversial Romans chapter 9 is. And mm-hmm. You know, there's a part in there where it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
Well, I did a little research with a colleague of mine by the name of Ted Wright, who's an archaeologist here. And just to show you the historical context of that passage, and I know you know this, but I'm saying this for my for the listeners out there. In Egypt, after you died, according to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, your heart was weighed against a feather.
Yes,
and if
the
your
feather
heart,
of truth.
What's that?
The feather of truth.
Yeah, the feather of truth. And if your heart was heavier than the feather, you were devoured by some sort of, the god's name was Amit. He was a combination of a crocodile, hippo, and lion. He would eat you.
Yeah.
And if your heart was light, then you would receive eternal life in the underworld or whatever.
Yes.
Now, that gives all new meaning to the harden the heart passages in there with regard to Pharaoh. You want to expound upon that? Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Well, no, I think that's one of many examples we could cite. And certainly we find, again, in the ministry of the early church, when they're taking the gospel into a primarily Jewish environment, they're relating gospel truth in the context of Jewish heritage, Jewish religion, mm-hmm. and culture,
mm-hmm.
Emphasizing the messianic role of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Then when the gospel is taken into a primarily non-Jewish, Gentile, or Greco-Roman, Hellenistic environment, the message, the emphasis of the message shifts somewhat. It's the same truth, obviously, but it's being presented in a different context. For instance, when the Apostle Paul takes the gospel message first to Europe, to Athens, and his lectures or teachings at the Areopagus, for instance, in Athens, he's essentially presenting Jesus Christ as the divine Logos. This is the principle of reason and truth that was a very familiar concept in Greco-Roman philosophy. And whereas they wouldn't have resonated so much with the idea of Jesus Christ being the Messiah of Israel, this idea of him being the personification of the divine Logos principle was one that resonated very well with them.
So Paul adjusted his apologetic based upon who he was speaking to.
Yes, his audience, yes.
And in that case, being the Greeks, he spoke to them as Jesus being the divine Logos.
Yes.
And obviously, he didn't preach from the Hebrew Scriptures because they wouldn't have believed that. And
right.
Oh, by the way, friends, those of you who are listening, you may have heard me mention this before, but I'm going to mention it again. We are actually going to that site this summer. We are going to Athens, and in addition to that, we're going to Ephesus, and we're going to Corinth, and we're going to Malta, and we're ultimately going to wind up in Rome. I'm co-leading a trip with my friend Dr. Bob Cornuke, who's the true, real Indiana Jones, and we're taking a cruise from Istanbul to Ephesus to Santorini to Athens to Corinth to Malta to Sicily to Pompeii to Sardinia and finally Rome, and it's this July, and if you're interested in going on this Footsteps of Paul cruise, you need to call 1-888-771-8717. That's 1-888-771-8717. Or you can go to livingpassages.org. That's livingpassages.org and click on the Footsteps of Paul Malta cruise. By the way, when we get to Malta, we're also going to be joined by Doug Gresham. He is the stepson of C.S. Lewis. He lives on Malta, and we're going to see the anchors of Paul's shipwreck, what we think are the anchors of Paul's shipwreck, when we're there at Malta. So it's going to be an amazing trip. It's July 16th to the 27th. So check out livingpassages.org for more on that. And it's just going to be an amazing trip. Anyway, let's get back to the idea of Christian anti-intellectualism. Paul certainly wasn't anti-intellectual. There's one guy who reasoned with people in the synagogue and outside the synagogue, Jeffrey, in order to show them that Jesus was the Messiah. How have we lost this today, Jeffrey? Before we do that, let's just talk about some of the causes in our modern culture today as to why we are at least non-intellectual and in some cases anti-intellectual. You mentioned here in this little pamphlet that part of this has to do with parents not teaching people, teaching our young people the truth and apologetics. Explain that.
Well, that's certainly an unavoidable reality, and I realize that the parents are under tremendous pressure today, more than ever. But I think when we're talking about the failure to prepare young people, young Christians, to endure the challenges that await them in college and post high school life and so on, it really does begin with family and the failure of parents to impart at least a rudimentary level of religious literacy to their children. And I'm so thankful for the home in which I grew up. Oftentimes, dinner time, meal time was a time of informal teaching. My father took his faith very, very seriously, and so oftentimes dinner time conversations, obviously we would include what we'd been doing during the day, how things had gone at school or in sports or whatever, but he really emphasized using that time to teach us and instruct us, and I appreciate that very much. And so if it wasn't his expositions on scripture, it was oftentimes related to current events and political and social issues and so on. So I think it's really precious time. You know, when you think about it, a child will have lived over 150,000 hours in the home before he leaves high school. Mm-hmm. And certainly this is time that should be better spent. Now, I think a second factor, though, is that public education in general and actually so much of private education has so excluded religion from the curriculum. In fact, it's essentially secularized education to the point where it's not performing its role as well. In no way is are most of our children getting any sort of holistic education.
All right, hold the thought, Jeffrey. We're going to come back with Dr. Jeffrey Beshears and talk how do we get to this anti-intellectual or at least non-intellectual state in our church today. Back in 2 minutes. Don't go away. You're back listening to Cross-Examined with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network website, crossexamined.org. What we do here is we present evidence for Christianity. We cross-examine ideas against it. So if you're down low on the FM dial looking for NPR, go no further. We're hopefully going to give you truth here, truth you can use. In fact, just before the break, Dr. Beshears, Jeffrey Beshears of the Areopagus Ministry, the Areopagus.org ministry down in Atlanta, a church historian or a historian in general, a man who also teaches apologetics and church history, was discussing that one of the reasons we're non-intellectual or maybe even anti-intellectual in the church is because of our current education system. Part of that is due to parents not teaching to their kids the truth of Christianity and why it's true. And I just came across on the website of our friends at Ratio Christi a great list of resources for kids. And I just put this on our blog at crossexamined.org. The blog entry is called Apologetics Resources for Kids. And our friends over there at Ratio Christi put together a long list of curriculum or curricula, however you want to say it, and books that you can get by age group, all the way down to elementary school. So if you're interested in it, I get this question a lot. You know, what do you have for kids? What do you have for young kids? Well, now there's a resource or at least a web page you can go to where you can get some books, get some curriculum, get some resources where you can do what Dr. Beshears was just talking about, and that is sit around the dinner table after dinner and go through some of these facts with your kids and teach them why Christianity is true. It starts in the home. Now, Jeffrey, you mentioned there's a couple of other causes in addition to parental education, public education, public and private education. There's a couple other factors that cause us to at least be non-intellectual, if not anti-intellectual.
Well, certainly popular culture can be absolutely stultifying in terms of its intellectual effects. We all know that. You know, it's absolutely a pervasive influence in American life. And, of course, popular culture, television, movies, music, and so on, rarely ever presents anything but a critical or perhaps a satirical view of Christianity. And, again, when we consider just how impactful and influential popular culture is, and the fact that it is primarily not just neutral, but oftentimes hostile toward the Christian faith, I think that has to be a strong factor. And another reason why diligent parents and diligent educators and diligent ministers and churches need to be very, very attuned to the influences coming through in popular culture. Now the fourth factor, and I think in many respects probably the most troubling, is the current state of church-based Christian education. Mm-hmm. And I think churches, by and large, are failing dismally in terms of preparing not just young people, but adults as well. And I think there must be a strong correlation here between the fact that, according to Barna studies, most Christian young people, most young people raised in Christian homes, at least church-going homes, lose their faith when they go off to college.
Well, they certainly lose their
without a strong foundation in Christian history and apologetics. Many adults really don't have the kind of confidence in their faith that they knew that they need to be bold and effective witnesses. So I think it can certainly suppress the desire that all sincere Christians would have, and that is to be able to share their faith in a winsome and effective way. But in lieu of a strong, you might say, intellectual foundation, it's rather intimidating to do so, especially in our culture today.
Well, they certainly, according to Barna, they walk away from the church. I don't know if necessarily know if they lose their faith. Some do lose their faith. I think you're right. But the numbers, I think the studies he's done have shown that they walk away from the church. Some come back to the church, obviously some never do, and they walk away from the faith. It is still a problem, however. And, you know, the other interesting thing that you mentioned in your booklet called The Problem of Christian Anti-Intellectualism, you mention in here that even the shows in the 50s, like Leave It to Beaver or Father Knows Best, never showed anybody dealing with God or church. You know, we always think, oh, the 50s, everything was so wholesome then. Well, even back then, the media didn't touch the church or religion. In fact, somebody told me recently that the most religious person on TV right now in any popular long-term TV show is Homer Simpson.
Well, at least Lisa Simpson, but Lisa's a Buddhist. You know,
well, the Simpsons deal with religion, at least on the show. Now, I don't watch the Simpsons, but that's what I've been told. It's probably true. I don't doubt it at all. I don't doubt that the Simpsons are probably the most religious group or couple on TV, because every other show is just purely secular. And if it has anything to do with religion, as you mentioned, Jeffrey, it's anti-religion, certainly anti-Christian.
Yes.
Now,
yes. Well, the Simpsons are churchgoers.
No, that's right.
But it's a very watered-down liberal church that they attend, and you can see the effects on their son Bart and certainly on the daughter Lisa. She's decided Christianity is hardly worth even considering. So years ago, Lisa, I understand, converted to Buddhism.
Oh, okay, I see. Now, all this was in effect predicted back in 1913 by a Princeton theologian, John Gresham Machen.
Yes.
Who warned, what did he warn, Jeffrey, for our listeners?
Well, Machen, like again, many Christian thinkers in the late 1800s and early 1900s, saw that this residual Christian influence on American society and culture was beginning to slip away. In fact, mm-hmm. it was eroding, frankly, rather quickly. And, you know, amid new challenges from Darwinism and
right.
Marxism, Freudianism, mm-hmm. and so on. And so Machen, who was a renowned Princeton theologian, issued the warning that if Christians failed to adequately address the intellectual challenges of their day, the gospel was going to be put on the defensive, and evangelism, he said, would be seriously hampered. And in fact, he went on to say that unless Christians really rose to the occasion and became more actively engaged in the culture and the great intellectual struggles and issues of our time, that the Christian faith would be increasingly perceived as little more than just a harmless delusion. Hmm. And he was calling on Christians to get actively engaged in the great intellectual struggles of their day and really take the battle to the enemy on their own ground in the universities and the seminaries. But, of course, unfortunately, his warning went largely unheeded. And I think it's rather obvious, looking back at the history of the 20th century, that Christians generally failed to respond to the intellectual challenges. And frankly, today we're definitely reaping the consequences of that.
All right, Jeffrey, how did we get here then? Give us a little bit of history, briefly, as to how we arrived in an evangelical church today, or in the evangelical church today. How do we arrive at least non-intellectualism, if not anti-intellectualism? How far back do you have to go to trace the roots of this?
That's a fascinating question, and frankly, it's a little bit more difficult to get a handle on than someone might think. Now, we typically date the rise of evangelical Christianity in America to the First Great Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
And the First Great Awakening started in the 1730s. Mm-hmm. It ran for roughly about 15 years or so,
mm-hmm.
and, of course, resulted in probably tens of thousands of colonists, American colonists, having spiritual conversions, coming to faith in Jesus Christ. Now, ironically, along with the fact that was, we oftentimes sort of date the rise of evangelicalism to that First Great Awakening, there was a popular strand within that movement that was itself an anti-intellectual movement.
Hmm.
And oftentimes when people think of the Great Awakening, they think of these great stellar pastors and evangelists such as Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield. And, you know, these are very impressive figures in American colonial history, and certainly had profound impact in terms of their ministries. But there were an awful lot of, you might say, George Whitefield imitators at the time as well. And one thing about the Great Awakening that even at the time was somewhat alarming was the renewed emphasis on emotionalism. Now, the basic theme of the Great Awakening was the new birth. And most churches in America at the time, and this would go for Congregational, Presbyterian, and also Anglican churches, most of them were not preaching consistently the doctrine of the new birth. And so that was the major emphasis of the Great Awakening. And certainly that was the essential message of people like John Wesley and George Whitefield and Edwards and others as well. But as I said, the doctrine of the new birth and revivalism in general became very quickly sort of a lowest common denominator approach. The point here was to get people saved, and in the process, a lot of the rigor involved in taking the Christian faith in its holistic sense, in a worldview sense, and applying it to the various issues of life was lost. And so some of those who opposed the Great Awakening originally, including many very prominent American clergy of the day, would argue that the revival itself was too much of an emotion-driven phenomenon.
Now, was this in response to sort of dead orthodoxy?
Well, it was. The emphasis on the new birth was very much a response to the fact that American Christianity by the 1720s and 30s had sunk to a new low. You know, we oftentimes think of the origins of American Christianity going back to the Puritans and so on, and the great fervor that they brought with them to America, with great Christian religious fervor. But by the second and certainly the third generations, that kind of commitment was very much on the wane. In fact, Puritan ministers by the second half of the 1600s were writing and speaking about their concern that New England society and the American colonies in general were becoming less and less influenced by Christian thought and values.
When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about the question nobody ever asks and should ask, because it's an integral part of the Great Commission. All this emphasis on emotionalism and getting saved overlooks one big critical aspect of the gospel that nobody ever asks, and we're going to get right into it after the break with my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Brashears. You're listening to Cross-Examine with Frank Turek on the AFR Talk Radio Network. Back in 2 minutes. Do not touch that dial. If you'd like to learn apologetics, ladies and gentlemen, and learn how to teach it, you need to come to Cross-Examine Instructor Academy this August 9 to 11. Go to our website, crossexamined.org, click on Instructor Academy, get all the details. Myself, Greg Kokel from Standard Reason, Brett Kunkel from Standard Reason, Richard Howell from Southern Evangelical Seminary, Ted Wright from SES, Larry Blythe will all be your instructors there. You're going to learn how to present I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist and tactics to defend the faith. Improve your presentation skills. Be somebody who can overcome some of this non-intellectualism and anti-intellectualism wherever you are. We want you to bloom where you're planted. We want you to be able to teach this material wherever you are. That's what the Cross-Examine Instructor Academy is all about. And this year we've revamped it. You're going to have a lot more time to present back to us. We're going to do breakout sessions, so you'll have more choices for content. Lectures, that kind of thing. It's going to be an amazing time. So check it out. And oh, by the way, just so you know, there's going to be an amazing biblical manuscript display or exposition here in Charlotte at that time in August. So there's another reason to come to Charlotte August 9 to 11. Now, Jeffrey, before the break, I was talking about there's a big question that no one ever asks. The question that we typically ask people when we're doing evangelism, if you were to die tonight and stand before God, what would you say to him? Why should he let you into his heaven? And, you know, the typical response is, well, if the person is religious at all, they'll say, well, either, I'm a good person or I put everything under the cross of Christ, right?
Yes.
Well, that question is a good question. We ought to keep asking it. But here's the question no one ever asks anymore, and we ought to ask it. And the question is, what if you don't die tonight? What are you supposed to be doing with your life here? You see, when Jesus came to give the Great Commission, he didn't say make believers of all nations. He said make disciples of all nations. Now, I think, Jeffrey, this gets right to the heart of this anti-intellectualism or non-intellectualism. It's much easier just to have emotion than it is also to have the head that goes with the heart. And it's much easier just to say, I believe, rather than to actually have reasons why you believe and to really know who God is and be able to share that with others. So,
well, there must be a reason why we're not immediately raptured after conversion.
That's right.
We're obviously here for a purpose, So I think it's really incumbent upon us to have a broader and more inclusive, more holistic understanding of Christian discipleship than what is oftentimes offered.
Well, what you mentioned the first Great Awakening. I know there was a second Great Awakening, which I think in your assessment was even more emotion-based than the first Great Awakening. Take a minute or two briefly to describe that.
Well, yes. About 60 or 70 years or so after the first Great Awakening, in other words, another generation or two later in the early 1800s, there was a second outburst of revivalism, and again resulting in just some phenomenal conversion stories, undoubtedly impacting tens, if not hundreds, thousands of Americans at the time. And this is the awakening, of course, that was many Christians associate, for instance, Charles Finney. He was certainly one of the most outstanding leaders associated with the Second Great Awakening. But like the first one, but actually even to a much greater extent, the Second Great Awakening was also very much an emotion-driven revivalism. And of course, it had many manifestations and many spinoffs. The Restorationist movement came out of that Second Great Awakening, where we got the Churches of Christ and the independent Christian churches and the Disciples of Christ and so on. It also spun off Adventism, Seventh-day Adventism, the Millerite movement, and so on. There was a proliferation of Christian communal groups during this time as well. And, of course, on the fringes of the Second Great Awakening, we had the expansion of Unitarianism and Universalism. But probably the most infamous new group that came out of this period were the Mormons. Mm. But, again, the evangelical, the mainstream evangelical church was not focused on holistic discipleship. Christian education was not addressing many of the most pertinent issues in the nation at the time, many of the most significant cultural and social and political issues. And as a result, revivalism, such as it was in the early 19th century, was primarily, a very emotion-driven phenomenon.
And then when we get to the 1920s, we run into a movement called fundamentalism, which was largely a reaction to, at least partially, to Darwinism, was it not?
Well, it was, in part. Now, coming on the heels of the Second Great Awakening, of course, was the Holiness Movement of the late 1800s. And then, of course, an outgrowth of the Holiness Movement as we move into the early 20th century was Pentecostalism.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these movements were pietistic movements, like the holistic, Holiness Movement, and many of them tended to want to disengage from mainstream society. Again, seeing the erosion of Christian values and influences in mainstream American society, including our education system, many of these new Christian groups wanted to just disengage. And fundamentalism, of course, will be one particular manifestation of that impulse and that trend.
Jeffrey, isn't it ironic that the people who want to disengage from society are actually the ones who are causing the society to degrade? Because if the Christians had been engaged, it wouldn't have been degrading to the extent it was. And by disengaging even further, they're ensuring the culture's demise.
Well, we're called, as you're well aware, to be salt and light.
Right.
And this is a high calling. It's a difficult calling. It's
that's
a difficult challenge. It's also risky. But that's our purpose.
That's
And too many Christians have wanted to retreat just within the safe confines of Christian country clubs, Christian churches, and so on. And the result has really been devastating on American society and culture,
and the church as well, because we are not engaging the culture, and we are not loving the culture. I mean, the people in the culture. And giving an intellectual defense for why we think that Christianity is indeed true. We've seeded all that, and no wonder we're not very effective in winning people to Christ and then discipling them. So, Jeffrey, we just got a few minutes to go. In your opinion, what can we do now to combat this non-intellectualism or anti-intellectualism that we see in the church today?
Well, the problems in our society and culture have become so obvious. We see the degradation of our culture, societal values, public morality, and ethics and so on. We look at our current economic situation, and we understand that it's due in large measure to just massive corruption and incompetence,
immorality.
A lot of corruption, both in the investment industry and also in our government. And perhaps, and I do believe more Christians now are beginning to realize just how perilous our situation is. We may have passed the point of no return.
Doesn't matter. We're supposed to fight evil and leave the results to God.
that's right. And whether we have passed the point of no return or not, our calling, our mission, our mandate remains the same. And that's to be true salt and light in our society and to stand for truth and justice and civility and decency in our society. So the church has largely avoided a lot of these issues, and the consequences, again, are, I believe, just absolutely devastating.
But in order to stand for the truth, you have to have the truth, so you have to get educated. You have to get educated yourself.
You know, in our best evangelical churches, there's oftentimes a strong emphasis on theology. And, of course, this is so essential, you know, these core beliefs that all Christians need to take ownership of. But essentially, theology just tells us what Christians have believed historically, or the inference being what we're supposed to believe. But apologetics really explains why these things are true. And so, again, it's a false dichotomy to sort of separate sound biblical teaching and theology from apologetics. And that would include, of course, cultural apologetics as well, an honest, sober, realistic, rational assessment of what's going on in our nation, and mobilizing Christians to become, again, the salt and light that we've been called to be.
You know, Jeffrey, a lot of people sit around watching TV all the time and have no real meaning or purpose to their lives. And even though the fight is difficult, I find it much more encouraging and much more invigorating to be involved in the fight for truth and standing for the truth. Even if you have to take the arrows, even if there are discouraging times, at least you're in the fight. At least you're out there standing for Christ. At least you're out there trying to be an ambassador for the one who suffered brutally for you.
Well, and so Frank, I sat and listened to several of your seminars in the past, and you are an absolutely marvelous, gifted, and highly motivating spokesman for the kingdom of Christ. And as you've experienced, when we challenge Christians to think deeper, to think more broadly, to think more comprehensively, about the issues of our day, not just what's going on in their personal lives, but also how this relates to all their relationships and our culture in general, it has an amazing transformative effect, or at least it has the potential to have an amazing transformative effect,
Jeffrey,
on people's spiritual lives.
And you're doing great work there at the Areopagus. You got to go to the areopagus.org to get more from Dr. Jeffrey Brashears. Jeffrey, thanks for being with me today. Great program, great insights.
You
need to know history, friends. Get it from Dr. Brashears at the areopagus.org.
With Dr. Frank Turek. Information about Cross Examined is available at crossexamined.org.